Hey, Gestalt Education Nation. New sponsor alert, new sponsor alert. Today, we're excited to announce Dynamic Disc Designs and Jerome Fryer. We have an awesome discount code for you. Just use the code Gestalt to get a little bit of money off on the Dynamic Disc Designs. They're the most realistic anatomical discs that we've ever seen. If you caught our episode with Dr. Stuart McGill, you saw an entire shelf full of them. Everything from cavitation instruction to disc dysfunction to SI joint dysfunction, all sorts of amazing
joint
stuff.
Joint movement, vertebral movement.
Absolutely. So go to Dynamic Disc Designs, use the code Gestalt. As always, you can use the code Gestalt on Core 360 belt to get a little discount on the belts there. We love to use that for biofeedback, for teaching respiration, intra-abdominal pressure, and how the abdominal wall should be working during function. And then the last one, use the code GestaltEducation10. Those will all be in the description in the podcast. GestaltEducation10 at humanlocomotion.com to get off some money off of all of his awesome gadgets and tools and rehab materials. What's your favorite, Brett?
He's got a trunk full, but I think, you know, integrating the Toe Pro in, I think, has been a game changer for us here at the office. So I think that would be my pick.
Beautiful. All right, guys, don't forget, use the code Gestalt, Gestalt Education 10. Visit the show notes and you'll be hooked up. Thanks. Enjoy the episode. All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Gestalt Education Show. Today, we are in Overland Park, Kansas. We are sitting down with the Silver Fox himself, Dr. Terry Elder. Dr. Elder, congrats. You got a little bit of an upgrade on your scenery at Cleveland Chiropractic School. We're excited that you're here. We're excited that you're here kind of promoting Cleveland. And this is my alma mater.
Yeah,
so
mine too.
I love that you're here being a part of the school and stuff like that. But Terry, you have an unbelievable reputation for being an amazing adjuster. Not only an amazing adjuster, but great teacher. I know that you and Corey, you kind of cut your teeth with Terry.
Sarah too,
everybody. And so today I want to, we're going to kind of break down manipulation. We're going to talk about a little bit of maybe some misconceptions with learning and teaching manipulation. And we're going to kind of just dive in here for a short little session, but hopefully with some really, really great, great information.
I think a good jump off point might be the whole idea in specificity, you know? So, I mean, I think that's like our profession definitely, even the smart people in our profession are still like, they still wrestle with the thought of specificity and how, you know, like when you move a joint, you're going to have multiple cavitations, and the research is clear on that. Dunning et al. And others have basically proven that when we adjust somebody, we're going to have multiple cavitations emanating from even like one joint. So maybe that would be a good starting point. 'Cause you were the first person I heard talk about that. So,
So if we took a typical joint with, say, the thoracics, we have four major facets that could, in fact, cavitate. Plus, we have costotransverse on each side and costovertebral, right? So that, although we have the addition of the ribs, the point is that's one. Mm-hmm. So if we were the most specific person in the world, if that was possible, we could, in fact, have multiple cavitations having the ultra specific contact, which would probably hurt a lot, but meaning the ultra specific contacts are usually very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But multiple cavitations probably should be the norm, but we shouldn't worry about it if we only get two either.
Right.
So does it cavitate that way because that's the fixed part and it's going to move, right? Another one is the occiput, right? For years, we thought it was a literal kidney bean-shaped area of mating surfaces, but in fact, there's two or three.
Two or three, yeah.
So you adjust somebody's occiput, it sounds like you broke them, and they are literally jumping up and down because it feels so good, and it's still very specific.
Right. So why do you think that's so hard for chiropractors to kind of reconcile that? Like, why is it such, because, you know, you, I mean, there's plenty of research to support it. Why not just embrace it? Why is it so hard?
Because we still think we're not following the research on what we're really contacting. We still feel like we're contacting
bones and not joints.
Right?
Yeah.
And the McGill and Ross Bresniak's research showed that there's a frictionless interface. So what we're really doing is, my definition of an adjustment is this. An adjustment is a setup or a position which initiates an action of motion with force applied. nothing else, right? So in other words, what the joint is already doing, it will continue to do so unless the force acting upon that joint is great enough to change the original position.
Right.
So again, our detail on setting up a patient correctly, right? That's why, because we're trying to set up that motion and initiate that. We can't be ultra specific on a spinous or a transverse or whatever. Even spinuses are very deep, even though they feel like they're surface. You know, by the time we get to transverse, we're probably 2.5-3 inches deep. So the specificity should be, did you create the motion that was intended? And how do we know that? Well, the only way we know that is repalpate them after we adjust them.
And even from a neurophysiologic standpoint, they actually, there's been research done that has shown whether or not you're on the spinous process, whether you're on the laminar, whether you're on the TP, it doesn't matter. You're getting the same neurophysiologic benefit. So there's no argument there because, you know, at times I feel like chiropractors will argue that, like, depending on the lever, it matters from a neurophysiologic standpoint. And they found that it absolutely does not. Yeah.
And both you and I do a lot of standing style adjustments. And oh my God, people freak out when we do those. And I still remember I was teaching in Nebraska at you've probably done one too, a convention in Nebraska. Yeah, yeah. There's like 100 people at least, and 90 of them are Gonstead practitioners. And I had a guy come up, he's in his 70s, 75. And he said, would you adjust my upper thoracics? And he says, nobody's moved them in 10 years. And he was just old and stiff. And I said, well, I'll only accept that if you let me do it the way I want to do it. And I palpated him. I knew there was no, I would break my thumb on a thumb mover, probably break my pisiform on a pisiform push. So I did a standing, just opened him up. And he was just giggling like a little schoolboy, you know, and like thought it was the best thing ever. And he was a Gonstead doc. And it's like, I thought he was just going to, you know, have a cow. But, you know, once you present it, you know, at the end of the day, when what we're good at besides palpating is actually moving stuff in the direction it's supposed to move.
Well, I think that brings up a good point, something that we were kind of talking about a little bit off air. One of your favorite topics is actually figuring out how to match the adjustment to the patient. And sometimes we get stuck in our ways, you know. Brett's an amazing thumb mover, so it would be really easy for you to just hammer and thumb moves all day long in every patient. But what are some of the cues or some of the things that go through your head when you're palpating that maybe will say, this patient is going to be good for this, or this patient's going to be good for this?
And I'm curious what Brett would say to this too, but for me, it's flexibility, right? So I can have a typical 120-pound, 5'7" lady, pretty flexible. I would kill to just do a thumb move. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get that extension. I'm going to get a little lateral flexion. But put her in a chair, and I'm going to knock the heck out of them trying to get them to move, or I'm going to try to create a different adjustment, which is going to change the biomechanics. And I think that's what happens when you don't understand how to match the adjustment to the patient, is you create other movements to get a cavitation, which aren't necessarily the same movement, right?
And sometimes too, I think to get them at that in-range point that you would be thrusting, the patient is so compromised. Like the patient that, for example, has like a, you know, hypermobility throughout their body. So, you know, their position for the seated move is so compromised.
Yeah.
Whereas like the thumb move takes all of that away. Mm-hmm. Thumb move is just, I think it's a great way because you're actually, the head is not moving. You have the head supported against totally the headpiece. So you can really, and that doesn't take anything away from the seated move. Like you said, it's just like that middle-aged guy who's just kind of got a lot of relative stiffness. They're amazing seated CT moves.
Yes. You know, like, so you're using your flexibility. That's my point. When I'm seated, doing seated adjustments, I need more power, right? That's the only time I do seated. If I can get away with a thumb move or something similar, I'm going to pick that. But I will say, you will have that same lady I was talking about who's maybe fairly flexible but has the worst CT fixation ever, you could get away with the seated adjustment without being overly aggressive, but only on that. In other words, somebody told me one time, and I probably told it to them first, it depends on your, it depends on what you palpate.
Right.
Yeah. Right? If it's a medium level fixation, but that's all they got, I'm a bench TM or bench, a thumb move.
Sure. All day long.
85% of the day. Right? But if it's me coming to you, Brent might be able to do it, but the garden variety doctor might have to go to something a little more vigorous.
Well, and I think the important point there is palpation. I would say the same thing you maybe would agree or disagree on, like depending on whether you can do a drop or a kick. For some reason, you can just feel it when you palpate. Yeah, and so exactly. I think that just comes with experience of feeling the fixation, feeling the palpation, hip mobility, things like that. And then once you get them into position, like, you know, you get a last second chance to palpate before you adjust, which then is going to give you a hint whether or not you're going to be successful.
The pre-palpation during the adjustment.
It happens all. I mean, that is like something time. That is so understated. And that's how you know, like, where you need to be, because you should be butting back up against a joint blockage. So you could actually say to different way, and like, I'm never going to do an actual palpation. I'm just going to set up all these different adjustments, and you would be fine because the setup is actually your second place to be able to adjust well.
I had this happen when I first got here, and students would be trying to adjust the SI, and they say, "Doc, come help me." And I'll get in there on the SI joint, and I'll do it. It's like, oh, this is horrible. This is not even barely holding the SI joint together. I said, "Help. How about flipping them over?" And I test that one. I said, do this one, right? Because it's, you feel it as you're setting it up. And they would just blow it up. And they would literally be for months adjusting the wrong side because of, and they weren't motion palpating at the time, let's be clear. But, you know, having the palpation skills, even up to including right before you thrust, is very important.
And George DeFranca talked about that. And him and I did a chapter in Levinson's book on manipulation, which was really fun for me just because to get his perspective too, like it would be like when you and I talk. And what he talks about is almost like a pre-thrust, which kind of builds in some safety. And, you know, when we talked to him, you know, Maitland had a similar concept where he oscillated the joint before he actually thrusted. And I like that idea because even that little oscillation gives you another chance to palpate. And it also is a way to kind of build in safety to make sure that you're not doing something that would potentially, you know, be risky. And I think that's like very, very understated. No one wants to hear it, but we've all been there. You set something up and you can't even put into words why you don't like it.
Yeah.
You just don't like it. And then so like then you know to switch.
But you don't like it because you've experienced either yourself or you've done it enough to know. You practice enough, both with your palpation. Like, I'll have people that'll go, oh, you know, it's like, and they're trying to adjust somebody's neck that is just literally, I don't know how their head stays on.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. Thing.
And it's like,
that's like the TikTok. I just can't even watch them because, like, what's getting done? I mean, these people aren't even needing the adjustment that they're getting. And then it's just so gross, even beyond that it's.
Well, I think it comes into say too with getting good at palpation is a skill, you know, and that's what it's impossible to put into research. It's impossible to quantify objectively, but palpation is such a skill that you get better and better and better.
Yeah.
You, Terry, I would expect you to be light years better than me at palpation because you've done it for so much longer. Same with you, Brett. But like, maybe can we talk about, and we've talked a lot about this a lot on the podcast, but I'm interested to hear what you say. What are some of the things that, you know, over the last 25 years that you've done repetitively that have gotten you better at those things? Maybe it's just pattern recognition. Maybe it's just, you know, sitting down and thinking about things, or what are some of the things that you've done in your daily life that have made you better at palpation?
I think I'm about 1,000 times better palpating with my eyes than I ever was when I started, you know, just recognizing postures, different things like that. I started with the original seated screen, which was the neutral zone, which meant you're not pushing in and testing in play. You're literally just giving it that 2 millimeters of wiggle. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Fay said at the time, you got to do this 1,000 times. Well, I did it 1,000 times, right? But it did help develop that skill. Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, at least what I see, is we're doing a little more motion palpation, especially the seated version, a little more toward in play, or maybe we're starting with neutral zone and then we find something and then we're testing it. But
well, to that point, one thing that got me on this theme of this end range is that I saw Lynn do a seated scan, and Lynn may say he's in neutral, but by the time he actually palpated, he had that at end range. And it really, that got me thinking, and just like some other things, just noticing it myself. Yeah. And I think like we're going to be on the right side of that argument. Like, because even people that think they're at mid range, if you politely video them and show them like in slow motion, at the time they're thrusting, they don't realize it, you know, but they're actually at end range, although in their brain, they think they're at mid range.
Yeah.
And I'm so confident on that. If you take any of the great adjusters in the world, he or she, if you video them, you will see that in extremities included, you will see that if they're getting a great outcome with it, cavitation or no cavitation, then you will see that they have that jointed end range.
But I was talking more of just the seated screen.
No, I know. I know. I wasn't.
But I have seen Lynn too. It's like he starts out and then he gets to that thoracic. He's getting a little deeper and I do the same thing.
Right.
But you know, and what helped me also, quite honestly, is helped me teaching, especially, is when I started using the Sphinx posture palpation to verify, because students probably don't work hard enough at the seated screen, because I really think you have to do it 1,000 times. And I asked, I was reviewing for a Tri-6 class the other day, and I asked him, have you done this 100 times? Nobody had done it 100 times. So it's not a skill, the seated screen, that you can do if you don't practice it, right? And it doesn't take forever, but it takes a while so you can, because, you know, it has to be second nature what you're doing for your body to shut off all the rest so you can actually perceive.
Right.
It's kind of like an adjustment, right? Your brain, your hands can't do what your brain doesn't know. So if I do a procedure until it's a motor pattern almost, then my brain is now free to do an adjustment or to do a perception of the joint stiffness or whatever.
And the research is really clear on dynamic palpation, in that actually people who are not even officially trained in specific dynamic palpation, they're actually still good at being able to palpate multiple big joint blockages.
Yeah.
And they're not so good at being able to palpate subtleties, which of course, you know, but like if you've done this as long as, you know, a lot of the people that are listening have, then you can feel subtleties. Like to me, it's so, it's just like, I can't even wrap my brain around someone says you can't palpate. It's so natural at this point, no special skill, just done it over and over again. But I think it's sometimes like a dangerous message for a student to say, oh, there's no reliability in palpation. So then what do you have then? Are you just randomly going to be adjusting people? Like how, you know, how destructive is that? And well, I mean, you're never, ever, ever gonna, in my opinion, do harm when you're on a massively stiff locked joint. I mean, like, if you look at all the horrific things that happen with manipulation, they're all happening with younger female, hypermobile, loose connective tissue, high Batten criteria. That's who this is happening to. So we should learn from that. And then the other thing too is like, the stiffest joint that you're going to feel is a geriatric patient who's got like a mid thoracic. And so often they have zero symptoms in that spot there.
Never.
So you That's can't really part. Use provocative. Yeah. Everybody wants to say provocative testing. I'm telling you that provocative testing means something, but it's not a gateway into whether or not you should adjust them. It just tells you what the pain generator is.
Well, and you have to separate right now. And I don't know what your clinic does, but part findings are a big thing to put in your notes. And so even with this class that I was working with, they didn't really understand parts don't mean adjust this spot.
Right.
Right. So you can have spasm, you can have pain, but it doesn't mean you should necessarily adjust that. In fact, probably most of the time, like you said, the stiffest joints don't suffer a lot of pain, except maybe a little pain during palpation versus less restrictive joints might have a lot more pain, maybe not the primary problem.
Right? And this is why it is so hard as a student when you're working on a bunch of young, healthy people, because the palpation is so hard there.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, like we were at the Adjust-a-thon a couple weekends ago. You have a room full of people. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to find somebody with an upper cervical joint blockage, yeah. A true one, you know. And so then it all reverses itself. So then you get out and practice, and then the palpation gets easier because you have massive joint blockages, yeah. And then the adjusting gets harder.
Yeah.
So it literally flips on itself, yeah. From, you know. So, and I think that as a student, the whole palpation thing is hard because everybody's young, healthy, and moving relatively well.
Well, and literally the group that I was working with the other day had never been said to them that...
Sorry to interrupt your episode, guys. I have to tell you about an important date to write down in your calendar, November 3rd through the 5th, the first annual Neurodynamics World Congress coming to you at Parker University in Dallas, Texas, November 3rd through the 5th. This is an amazing opportunity to see a true Gestalt weekend, meaning integration of multiple different people, multiple different techniques of the likes of Michael Leahy, Antonio Stecco, Brett Winchester talking about DNS, Annie O'Connor talking about pain classification mechanisms, David Seeming talking about the internal chemistry, Jeff Bove talking about the research around nerves, and of course Michael Shacklock talking about neurodynamics. This weekend at Parker University, November 3rd through the 5th, is your opportunity to see not only lectures but hands-on demonstrations and panel discussions at the end of every day to combine this all together to show how each of these different techniques is influencing the nervous system. This is an amazing opportunity to see all these people in one stage and one opportunity to have some fun with us in Gestalt Education. So thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode, and we can't wait to see you at Parker University. It's November 3rd through the 5th. Registration open at gestaltedu.com/courses. See you there.
If you're not finding anything in the mid-cervical spine, hallelujah means that's what you're probably finding,
right?
That PDA movement in the cervical spine in younger people your age, there's not a lot there.
And the other thing too, the biggest, I think, not misconception, but error in palpation is the inability to distinguish between joint blockage and soft tissue tightness.
Yeah.
So, and that's where, like, if we, you know, if you're not comfortable seated, we can get the patient off weight bearing. Supine palpations for the cervical spine, I think, really expose that well.
Yeah.
And, you know, Syriacs was the first person that I can find to actually talk about the importance of being able to distinguish those two. And I think one of the biggest problems for students, at least, is they think something's blocked because they're feeling soft tissue restriction versus pure joint blockage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whatever we can do to, you know, get the soft tissues out of the equation, that way it you know, you'll find more success with your adjusting, I think, if you're able to do that well. Yeah.
Well, I think, like, teaching these things is difficult too, because, you know, as you're tasked with teaching the tri-six, what the difference between those two is, sometimes it's just experience and building that into your hands. But I think it's also paying attention. You know, if we look at, like, Erickson's research, right, from Peak, like, it takes time, but it takes committed time, meaning you have to actually pay attention to what you're looking
at. It's not necessarily 10,000, the 10,000 rule. It's how much you're committing to do it, you know?
And deliberate practice is what he uses. And that's like, and I think a majority of our profession, they just punch widgets. They actually don't, like, think about their cases. They don't see the changes they made. They don't come back and palpate to make sure that, like, what they did is... You know, I think that's a really good point, Taylor.
Which I think, too, is, like, even in chiro school, it was... For me, even, it was a success if you got a cavitation. That's what success was built around. And in reality, that's just, like, the farthest from the truth. Yes, it's awesome when you cavitate a joint. That's amazing. But if I think we just have to – we need to change what the actual goal is of education and learning, which is getting good with your hands to be able to distinguish when you're going to cavitate a joint. You know, like, Terry, you know when you're going to cavitate a joint when you set up on it.
I call it calling the ball, which means if you're familiar – and I hope I get this right. But an Air Force plane coming down on a carrier has a ball there. They have to know if they're going to be okay, or they have to go back off,
right?
I did that at a seminar I was teaching in New Mexico. I was explaining that, and I said, I can pick 10 of you and tell you if I'm going to move it, and which ones I'm going to be able to move.
Right.
and I missed it by one, right? I said, I'm not going to be able to move you, three of you, but I'm going to move all seven of you. And I got eight of them instead of the, sure. I was better at it or something on that eighth one. But
I think another important point too, and we kind of, we're starting to talk about it a second ago, is like this serial experience of adjustments, whereas, you know, you see that new patient who's never been to a chiropractor and they have, you know, extreme stiffness and we'll say their thoracic spine, and like just being patient and like understanding like today I don't have to go for broke because I might fracture their rib. Like yeah. We just start gentle. And then if you give yourself enough time to be successful, like in 3 weeks, now you're actually starting to cavitate the joint. The joints are starting to move. Then you can start to use more aggressive moves.
Yeah.
Like the thumb move that we teach, like one of the modifications is like where we take the head out and rotate. Well, some of our patients don't have that kind of motion there early on.
I don't.
So what do? We start with other ways. We might start seated. We might start supine in the sagittal plane, start building in some motion there. And then you almost use the thumb move as a new audit because now they can actually turn their head. And that can be criteria for like you're
They're
moving
improving. Along.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you're showing them. And I think that is also a really understated point that you may be doing a different adjustment with the same patient in the same region 3 weeks from now, just because they're starting to get better movement there.
And I'll tell you, you were mentioning cavitation. I think cavitation is why we have so many different technique systems, because all chiropractors, even some of the best, assume that if it cavitates, they did something right.
Yeah. Did it go?
And they might not even be following normal biomechanics or whatever, or the aggressive supine, I won't call the name, but supine Y-strap style adjustments. Well, it cavitates a lot, so it must be right, right? We're not looking at risk. We're not looking at biomechanics. Right.
Or outcomes.
Or just outcomes.
Because it cavitates doesn't mean you got a good outcome. You
know? Well, what's like, interesting on the cavitation, too, is like with Walter Herzog's research from Calgary, we know that whether or not it cavitates is not changing the neurophysiologic benefit of the adjustment. The quickness of the maneuver is. Now, Sato did a little bit of research that's kind of was showing that maybe the cavitation was important. But the one thing that the research is clearly showing now, unrefutable, is that the cavitation is important to the patient.
Oh, yeah.
So there is no refuting that. Yeah. So then, like, I think educating the patient on what cavitation is, how that's not really our goal. And on Bresnik, Ross, and McGill's paper, when they studied cavitation, where they put the microphones in the around the spine, and they determined that, you know, we're only accurate half the time was the conclusion of the paper. But no, you're never going to hear an MPI instructor say that, you know, our goal is cavitation, right? We just said cavitations are coming from, you know, that's not the most important thing for what we do. And it's about being able to reassess joint play. And that's what our goal should be. And if your patients understand that and they're educated well on that, then you can really answer their question when they look up at you and they say, did that go? Then you can give them an educated answer. Like we try to do at our office. We're like, nothing's changed. You know, it doesn't matter if it cavitates or not. Like we're,
and I think I at least have, and you probably have too, been to a seminar where everything is a what I call a take no prisoners adjustment, just to impress or whatever. And we as at the school have students that go to seminars like that also, and they'll come back, a lot of extremity ones especially, and they'll have injuries, you know, they have outright injuries that take weeks to recover from just because absolutely everything has to cavitate or else, you know. And it's like, I love cavitation, but I don't lose sleep about it. Right.
That's exactly right.
Quickly, I mean, a lot of people heard me tell a story, but I always like kind of liken it to when you were a student, you went home for Christmas and you're adjusting a family member. And let's just say that it's Monday and you blow up the joint from a cavitation standpoint. And then you see them on Wednesday and they're like, hey, can you do that awesome adjustment again? And you do the same thing and nothing happens from a cavitation standpoint. And then that just tells you how powerful mentally the cavitation is, because the irony of that situation is more than likely they're actually better. Like you've restored joint plane, they've been able to maintain it, but in their mind, they feel like that you've forgotten how to do that in the last 48 hours. And the huge irony is that as you walk away from that situation, that family member actually thinks they're worse off at that point because nothing went. And the oxymoron is they're probably ironically actually better.
Better.
But that is how powerful that education is, so important in what we do. And nobody wants to talk about it. But I think that's a very important point.
Because, you know, all the research and papers talk about 50% of all health effects from any healthcare provider are placebo. Right. Well, it's pretty obvious to me that cavitation is hugely placebo for our patients, whether it is for us or not.
Right.
Right. So that neurological placebo effect that we have, I think, is enhanced with cavitation. But again, that's why education is the key, because placebo is affected by education. I've read papers where the weirdest procedures have the highest placebo effect, which is crazy, but, you know.
I think, too, it's a mistake, and we've worked really hard at MPI to kind of get us out of the stigma, which is, you know, like at least when I first got involved, it was like, well, MPI is only seated cervicals, for example.
Exactly.
And that is a huge mistake, like, because then, and I always say to myself, I mean, my gold medal move was a seated CT for that. I mean, I just thought that that's just the only move I'd do for the CT junction. And then, like, just playing around with the thumb move and other moves, honestly, too, and just being like, there is a case like we talked about earlier that, like, I don't care who you are, like, I mean, or you are going to absolutely have to thump them or put them in a completely compromised position to get the movement that you want. So, I mean, I think,
or change the adjustment. And a lot, I've seen a lot of people, you know, and I always look at what's happening to the patient. And, you know, one of the best ways to experience it yourself.
Does
it feel like it's moving that area, or does it feel like it's cavitating somewhere else? So I've tried to have everybody adjust me when I suspect it, you know, to see if I was correct in thinking, well, maybe it's not actually doing what we're thinking it's doing.
It's like Hank Haney, the golf instructor. He says, like, he doesn't even want to watch the golfer swing. He just wants to watch the ball trajectory. And he can tell whatever he needs to off the, like, what the golfer is doing by just looking at the thing. And I think it's true. Like, when people send us videos of, like, who are struggling with an adjustment, if we're talking about your famous occiput move, you can watch what their head does to the adjustment. You can know exactly what they're, you know, doing or not doing. So I think that's a really good point. I mean, if you're struggling, just video yourself and watch what the inside posture, same thing. I mean, like, you can basically watch what the body's doing and basically determine what they're probably not doing well.
Well, what I have been doing, and it's not that recent, but I started having them, like you said, I would have them video themselves, have a friend video them while they're doing a drop, and then they'll video me, and it'll say, well, just compare the two, and their brain thinks they're doing it right.
Right.
You know? But when you see the video, you know, even I've found things when I'm watching myself do particular adjustments.
What's funny, the little nuances, even from going left to right on yourself. Like, when you're young, like, if you're struggling with something, video it, because what you'll see on the side that you're struggling on, you'll see, like, a gross discrepancy of, like, in your setup, you'll be like, wow. Oh. Like, when I'm on my left side, I'm doing something completely different.
I have two classic examples of that. The first one is when I first started learning seated cervicals, right? And for whatever reason, I supinated really well with my left hand, but my right hand, for whatever reason, I had an issue. And I was also having biceps tendonitis and a bunch of other stuff. Well, that was eventually fixed when who's the first guy over? Was it Yonda with all the muscle stretching and stuff? He gave a seminar at National, and he was talking about, you know, muscle shortness and PIR and all that. So I had him do it on my bicep, or actually on my common flexors, and it was the most amazing thing I've ever had done. I literally could feel individual muscle fibers almost, like, just releasing, you know. And you've spent time over in
check. You,
check.
Yeah.
You've seen these guys. You've done that stuff. You've seen it. But for me, it was like, oh, my. Because I had had my elbow cranked and I'd had, you know, all this stuff. But stretching on my tiptoes, you know, just massive, aggressive stretching. And in 5 minutes or less, my elbow was straight for the first time in 20 years, right? And all of a sudden, I could do the right side on the seated cervicals, right? The second one was I learned the upper rib adjustment supine from Dr. Lustig from St. Charles, Missouri. I don't know if you've ever run
into
him.
I know the name, yeah, I do.
And I was the best left-sided rib adjuster on the planet. And I couldn't do the right side. And we did not have videos available, cell phones. Took me 2 years. To this day, I don't know what I did differently, right? I don't know how I got out of being so bad on the other side. If I would have had a video, I could have, like you said,
figured it out.
That difficult side, I could have probably seen what I was doing wrong, but it took me an entire 2 years because I was like clockwork, you know, it was that one side, I would just nail it, I'd go to the other side, it's like, oh, you know, and I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
I know when you're adjusting C0, C1, I know your preference is to contact the occiput versus the atlas. If you were 100% honest with yourself, Terry, do you think that it matters whether or not, yeah. So, doctor, I don't either. Doctor's preference, right?
Like, well, here's the thing. I break this down. So, I think the occiput is easier in some cases to do. Either for fun, I'll do the atlas. That's one. Sometimes it's kind of like doing kicks and drops, and sometimes you just get bored.
Right.
But
it's all about the patient, though.
Yeah.
Well, it is, but I know I'm going to give them the same excellent thing either way. So, but if I have a very stiff patient, it seems like the atlas will work more effectively than the occiput. I don't know why. Maybe a better lever. I don't know. In the same way, if I have that flexible female a lot of times, super flexible, I mean, but still have an occiput fixation. If I fail on the occiput, which is very rare, I will do the atlas and it works. So I almost do the atlas just for fun or demonstration or because I failed. And it works equally well on super stiff, like old men, or actually super flexible. I was teaching in New York, and I was demonstrating the occiput before we went to lunch. That's kind of, you know, after the lecture and everything, I usually demonstrate that first.
Yeah, leave him with that.
And so I had this guy, he volunteered, he came up, he was at least as old as I was, but massive anterior head carriage, you know, this kind of look. And I hit him, and it was nice, but it didn't cavitate. And as I was eating lunch, when I don't get something to move, I'm not rattled about it, but I think about it. I go, you didn't finish the story. So I came back and I said, when you have a very, you know, and so we did exactly the same adjustment, but contacting the atlas, no increase in force, no change of set, you know, and it moved just fine. Like, it was an easy adjustment.
You know, it was kind of, back in the day, sexy to talk about Kalten boards, concave, convex rule. We've kind of abandoned it. Do you think, is there any merit to it? Or do you think, like, we just need to, it just confuses people, and we just need to kind of be done with
it? I think it confuses people, and I don't think there's any way to prove it or disprove it.
Right.
You know, it's like, does it flex? Does it extend? Does it
laterally
flex?
You go to the opposite side, which, you know, we used to teach that. I mean, like, you know, like if you, for example, felt joint blockage at C0, C1 and you were contacting the occiput on the left, if you wanted to have the same effect, then we taught that you had to come back on the atlas on the right side. And, you know, and then finally, I remember just being like, there's no way. I mean, when you're young, you don't know any better. So you're just doing what you're told. But then, like, you can clearly see how that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
But, okay. Let's talk about ribs for a sec. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, people talk about, is it worth, from like a HVLA standpoint, assessing the anterior ribs? Like, would you ever do like an anterior rib move? You know, and so like other technique systems, they have answers for this. Obviously, it's, you know, it's not a joint that cavitates really. So, but do you feel like it's worth joint planing? And do you feel like there's a move that is necessary that would remedy joint blockage from the anterior side of the rib cage? Leave the posterior out. We know.
So I have to include the posterior in the explanation. Would you hold that? So I think ribs follow thoracic spine. They're attached, right? So if we think of most people when we're working on their thoracic spine, when we're doing extension, they have an increased kyphosis, right? So the ribs also follow, right? And because of that position, that anterior costotransverse ligamentous structure, I believe, kind of shortens over time. So if we're adjusting the thoracics, we're starting to open that up and lengthen that ligament. At the same time, if I'm doing the rib adjustment, I'm still creating that anterior part of the costotransverse capsular structure is starting to lengthen. Okay? In the same way, if I'm more flat, like, and I'm sure you've seen this, where maybe they do have a C7-T1 restriction, but they have that true flat spot, maybe from T2 to T5, those people often have that anterior rib pain, which I think, I don't care about the pain, but I might do an adjustment from the anterior, which creates a lever into flexion, where I can then affect the posterior part of that costotransverse articulate. So although the move might be delivered from the front, it still cavitates in the back.
Right.
And is still affecting the costotransverse. Well, we hope it's affecting the costotransverse articulation. But at the same time, that's only if I can't just fix the problem by raising the headpiece and putting them into more flexion.
Right.
I think 90% of the time, if you just flex the headpiece, you're going to get the same result. The more difficult ones are when I'll do an anterior contact to still affect the posterior
costotransverse. I think, too, if you take the supine patient this week and just start, hear me out, play around a little bit, you can joint play these articulations, and you can actually feel joint blockage. Yeah,
they're tender. I palpate it.
But they're also blocked, too, besides tenderness. They're tender. Yeah. And I mean, in DNS, we teach Moshishava's mobilizations where we actually use the tension in the muscle. But I always kind of revisit the fact of maybe, you know, different ways that we could be maybe capturing that, or it's just one of those areas of the body that with unique anatomy that there's not a direct answer to that, or it's getting cleared out, like you said, by something that we might be doing in a post here. Now we talked to Lynn, he's adamant that chiropractors are missing a lateral flexion thoracic joint blockage. And he actually has a side posture move that really you need kind of a softer table to be a Duke. He's basically doing a body drop with a double thumb. Yeah. So we can talk about the move, but right now I want to ask, like, I feel like in the thoracic spine, like, we really do a lot with rotation, and we do even more in the sagittal plane. Do you agree with that? Like, So lateral flexion is just kind of, it's obviously coupled. We know that depending on where you are.
I think it's coupled. I think you need sagittal plane motion to participate well with others, meaning rotation or lateral flexion. But if I had a lateral flexion problem during the supine maneuver, I can simply put them into lateral flexion.
A little bit of lateral flexion. Yeah, right.
And I don't think that's I think literally we achieve most of what we're doing in 85 to 95%. And that's when the little subtle things like a lateral flexion fixation.
So let me just ask it this way, just to totally put your feet to the fire. If you're palpating someone's thoracic spine, are you taking the time to palpate lateral flexion like you might be in the cervical spine or the lumbar? I mean, are you literally laterally flexing them in joint plane, or have you kind of gotten away from that and everything that you just said you can kind of neglect?
Well, because again, I think if we stick with sagittal plane in the beginning of care, and if sagittal plane totally cleared itself out, I don't think you need to do any more.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, I will say this, that's below.
I think you're right.
Below,
I do, for the record.
Below the upper thoracics, I think I'd like to pay more attention to C7, T1, T1, T2. But everything below that, if it extends and flexes, because we do have some oddball patients who actually need flexion in certain parts of the lower thoracic spine. And literally, they're super rare, but it's miraculous when you find it and you help them with that. But other than that, most people respond to extension or rotation.
I think, too, I mean, if you think about it, even from a philosophical standpoint or a biomechanical standpoint, you can clearly see if you karate chop my neck here, I'm creating lateral flexion. Yeah. We don't do that in the thoracic spine because of just the anatomy there. Mm-hmm. So when you're making a contact, no matter what you do, you cannot get pure lateral flexion like you can here. You have to, you're on, because there's stuff there, you're on the spinous process. So you're, no matter what, you're not getting pure lateral flexion in that point. And I know Lynn would disagree.
And I don't even palpate it pure anymore.
Right.
I palpated coupled, and instead of, so one of the things that happened with McGill's original work was when they did the cadaver work, they actually found that the vertebrae is almost spongy in a fresh non-formalin cadaver, and the spinuses were very mobile, but not always both directions. So my thought was, which might not be any better, since it couples anyway in the thoracic spine most of the time when it has some kyphosis, that instead of pushing on that spinous, I'll just loudly flex them and push on the lamina on the other side. I don't know if that's perfect or anything else, but it gets me away from the possible misconceptions by doing lateral flexion on a spongy spinous process.
I think that to that argument, I don't know how to answer it well, but I feel like you already take that into consideration with your hands, that there's some,
there might be
some plasticity in the spinous, I think
we're not at the tip of the spinous. We're almost on the lamina anyway, when we're palpating.
Right.
And I do it both ways, but the point is, I'm still going to stick to the idea that if you do sagittal plane in most of the thoracic spine and the lumbar spine, I think lumbar spine lateral flexion is just fun and more comfortable for your super weird flexible people than straight P to A style adjusting.
Well, I think too, like, even if you take, like, if they're side posture and you take a bilateral contact, if you watch in slow motion, there's always going to be lateral flexion built in by means of you dropping on them.
Because you're dropping, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like that motion's forgotten upon, even though you're taking a bilateral contact, So, yeah.
Good job, guys. 46 minutes.
Wow.
I know. Okay. We riffed on some really good stuff there at the end.
Yeah.
So, I don't know about you guys. I have a hankering for some barbecue.
If you're in Kansas City, you eat barbecue.
So
they're trying to kind of bully us into a Jack Stacks. I think we're going to stay strong with the Q39. That was cute that they thought they
just
could change our
opinion. You're going to make Marianne sad.
No, that's all right.
So are you sure? Look at that face. Are you sure that you want to make Marianne sad?
The pork belly is stronger than Marianne, so I think we're... anyway, we'll have this argument on there.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. Dr. Elder.
Thank you.
Thank you for
your influence.
Jerry.
We appreciate you, brother. Keep changing the world one student at a time, and we'll see you next time. All right, guys. Well, good luck with patients, and keep learning. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Gestalt Education Show. If you liked it, share it, subscribe to it, send it to your friends, send it to someone that needs to hear this message. We really want everyone to be able to tune in and get the best clinical advice that they can, which we're hoping that we're giving to you with these special guests. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us, or if you have any suggestions on upcoming conversations, let us know. For a list of our upcoming courses, we're adding them all the dang time. So go to gestaltedu.com, click on courses, and they'll all be right there for you. All right, have a good day.